Welcome to the CSIS Cogit Asia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start as we always do with the region's news. In Hawaii, Secretary of Defense Ash Carter said that the United States will continue to remain the principal security power in the Pacific region for decades to come. On the first leg of his latest trip to the Indo-Pacific, Carter argued that China's actions in the South China Sea are bringing regional countries together in new ways and increasing the demand for American engagement. Secretary Carter also presided over the retirement ceremony for Admiral Sam Locklear, who will be succeeded by Admiral Harry Harris as the head of U.S. Pacific Command. In addition, Carter reaffirmed the U.S. treaty commitment to the defense of the Philippines during a meeting with Philippines Secretary of National Defense Voltaire Gazmin in advance of the Shangri-La dialogue this weekend. In New Delhi, India and Vietnam signed a five-year joint vision statement on defense cooperation to enhance their strategic ties against the backdrop of China's land reclamation in the South China Sea. Both India and Vietnam's defense ministers validated the document, which is believed to include a section on cooperation in maritime security, as well as concluding a separate agreement between the coast guards of the two countries. In Tokyo, the Diet began considering a set of security bills that would expand the scope of overseas activities by the Japan Self-Defense Forces. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe emphasized that the only scenario his government had in mind for applying collective self-defense in the Middle East was that of minesweeping in the Strait of Hormuz. In Seoul, the South Korean Ministry of National Defense reported this week that North Korea is building military facilities on a border island in the West Sea that authorities believe will house 122mm multiple launch rocket systems. Intelligence reports show that North Korea is constructing several bunker-shaped camps on Gal Island, located just 4.5 kilometers away from the South's Yongpyeong Island, where an exchange of artillery shellfire killed 4 South Koreans in November 2010. And that's the news. Here at CSIS, we continue to track the progress of Chinese President Xi Jinping's economic reforms and anti-corruption campaign. Recently, CSIS Freeman Chair in China Studies, Chris Johnson, hosted a wide-ranging conversation with two prominent China-watching economists, Barry Naughton of the University of California, San Diego, and Tom Orlick of Bloomberg, during a China reality check event. And we hear from them now.
To what degree does the uncertainty of the purges and the anti-corruption campaign weigh here in the sense that in the best of times, it wasn't that risk-taking a society, and now there must be much more fear of taking risks. And that sort of then plays into your thoughts on Nicholas Lardy's point that a lot of decision-making and power has moved from the state to the private sector.
Unquestionably, you know, the anti-corruption campaign and the other thing we don't necessarily think of in the same basket with that, though, is the sudden disruption in terms of what success indicators are for people. So that they face not only, it's not just more risky, it's also a lot less fun. and there's a lot more uncertainty about what they're supposed to be doing. And you do see, it's funny in some of the things, including that NDRC plan for the year that I just mentioned, you see a certain amount of new emphasis on, hey, we really need to tie specific reform objectives to the, you know, the success indicator of local officials, sort of more or less officially recognizing that what you're saying is a problem, is a problem. You know, people are dragging their feet because they're not sure what to do. You know, I guess in terms of Lardy's book, I think that, you know, it all depends on what time framework you're looking at. I mean, the title of the book says it all, right? Markets over Mao, if you're making the comparison with 35 years ago. Of course, that's absolutely right. I mean, my God, the economy is predominantly private, and that's a key driver of the success of the economy. I don't think there's any question about that. So, you know, in some ways, I would focus on a slightly narrower time frame. I think there has been a, let's say, a consolidation of the state sector over the last 10 years, and maybe this is very subjective, so it's really hard to measure, but what you often heard, say, 5 years ago from people in China was that it was more difficult to do business as a private entity without having some kind of connection or some kind of patron in the government. And so in that sense, that private decision-making had been eroded somewhat. That's something I would worry about, but I couldn't prove it. You know, there's no objective indicator that shows that that's true.
I'd just build on what Barry said by noting that I think this is one of the, you know, we talk about the new normal in the economy. What I find striking is that there's a bunch of new normals across a variety of different things.
That's for sure.
And one of those is, as you just alluded to, how being a local official has gone from one of the best jobs in China to one of the worst, and you know how difficult that is for them. And one of the issues, you highlighted it in your comments, Barry, about the pay for state-owned enterprise managers, and I think we see this also for local officials, where the central message on any corruption and in the frugality campaign is effectively, hey, you know that social contract we've had for the last 30 years where you get paid a poor official salary, but you get the Hongbao, you get, you know, all these other, that's gone. You're on the emperor's grain now. And this is, I think, causing a real serious rethink among smart people just at the time when the rub of these reforms, where they really need that technical expertise and so on, is coming into play. And I think they face a real serious brain drain issue and problem.
So, I have a slightly more optimistic take on the anti-corruption campaign. So I would really cast it in terms of Xi Jinping's capacity to push aside the vested interests, which everyone says are the main barrier to reform. So if you go back in time to the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao era, everyone said, okay, we'd love to do reform, but the state-owned enterprises, the local governments, they're too powerful, we can't do anything about it. Well, what have Xi Jinping and Wang Qishan done? They've come into power, they've grabbed the head of SASAC, they've grabbed the heads of the major state-owned enterprises, they've grabbed heads of local government. It's part of the clean governance anti-corruption campaign, but it also sends a very powerful signal. If you mess with us, if you oppose our efforts on anything, including economic reform, then woe betide you. Now, I think that there is a reasonable concern about what impact this has on China's government system. Does everybody say, the corruption investigators are out there, the safest thing for me to do is to hide under my desk, I'm certainly not signing any bits of paper. And I'm definitely not gonna eat at a luxury restaurant. Now, I think intellectually that makes a lot of sense to me, but actually if you look at where that should be showing up in the numbers, I don't see it showing up in the numbers. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the investment data, the only bit of investment that's accelerating is infrastructure investment, which requires a sign off from local governments. So I don't think they are sitting on their hands. If you look at luxury spending, which is meant to be this index of whether the frugality campaign is taking hold or not, you can certainly find evidence of areas where it's come down. Macau is doing really, really badly. But it's not a universal picture. I was in Seoul recently. The duty-free store in Seoul is rammed with Chinese luxury shoppers. There was a queue at the Prada store, and I was kicked out for taking a picture of it. Even though I was using a Samsung phone, which got me out of the problem. So I think the corruption campaign is I think there's a positive read on it in terms of its relationship with the reform agenda, and I get the point that it could be really confusing and freezing up the government machine, but where I look for evidence of that happening, I don't see it.
In the back there.
Thank you. My name is Hong Zhang. I'm a PhD student from George Mason University. So for both of speakers, my question is, to what extent do you think the whole set of financial reforms represent a breakaway from the Chinese model of political economy, in the sense that in the traditional model, the state-owned commercial banks have played crucial roles in providing funds for local governments and to state-owned enterprises for the investment-driven economic growth. So now the commercial banks are moving toward a more market-oriented direction, and local governments are also pushed toward a more, let's say, more market-oriented fundraising model. So what's the implication for the whole political economy? And that would tie back to the question of Lardy's book, which is to what extent the state economy still plays a central role in the Chinese economy, and what's the implication for the whole political system? Thank you.
In 3 minutes.
Yeah, those are good questions. But let me specify that there are sort of two different questions, right? And so let's look at the first one first. I mean, if we move away from a system of financial repression where, you know, quantitative controls are really used to steer predominantly bank credit to especially privileged beneficiaries, that results in some change in the allocation of resources. The state doesn't have the same kind of prior claim that it used to have. But it doesn't mean that local infrastructure investment has to disappear. I mean, the government has lots of money. It has lots of taxation authority. It has lots of clout in all kinds of different ways. So it's, I mean, personally, I would hope that the investment rate would, in fact, come down gradually over time, several percentage points. I think that would be consistent with a better functioning economy. But you know, we know that the modern financial systems actually are more efficient in a way that kind of gives you a percent or two of a GDP, you know, kind of efficiency bonus. So, you know, I think that would be a very positive transformation that's still consistent with China still being a very high investment economy in any kind of comparative sense. What was the second part?
I didn't catch the second part.
Is it going to change the kind of whole political economy of China?
What?
Is a liberalized financial system going to change the whole political economy of China?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, there is an argument that a modern financial system plus an open capital account can have, you know, very fundamental effects, not just on the efficiency of the economy, but also on sort of the distribution of power. People sometimes turn to, say, Indonesia as an example of this. It definitely provides a check on government decision making that I think can be quite positive in the Chinese case.
So apparently, Lenin said, all communist governments need one very large bank, which is a great quote, and I've always wanted to use it, but I've never been able to find the original attribution, so I'm not sure whether he actually said it or not. And I think that goes to the kind of the evident truth that if you control the flow of credit, that gives you massive influence over a whole range of different things. Now, by liberalizing the financial system, I think when we talk about the liberalization of the financial system, I think we have to recognize that we're talking about the liberalization of financial instruments. Mm. We're not talking about a shift in the ownership of China's big banks. So ICBC is now going to be operating in a market-based interest rate system. However, ICBC is still majority owned by the Chinese government. So I think it will continue, it will hopefully operate in a more efficient way, but the Communist Party will still have one very large bank. So.
Although, I mean, I guess to me the main difference is in the first system, it's so easy to hide different kinds of costs so that nobody can really perceive them. ICBC, if the financial system reforms succeed, yes, ICBC starts out state-run, no question about it, but two things are different. One is it has to compete on more or less equal terms, and some of the competitors will do better, and some of them are private. But the other is that ICBC's bottom line is going to be increasingly driven by things that ICBC can't control. And so when the government says, hey, by the way, we'd like you to fund this, then ICBC is going to push back and say, well, we can't fund that because, you know, it's going to hurt our bottom line, it's going to hurt our shareholders, including you.
Right there on the edge.
Good afternoon. Edmar Santos, Air Force Intelligence Analyst with DIA. My question is, with China's economy slowing down, how do you see it affecting their vision of global economic engagement, for example, in their One Belt, One Road initiative?
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble.
It's with the economy slowing down, how do you see that impacting their global economic engagement, especially under like One Belt, One Road?
Yeah. Well, so far, no impact because as domestic demand is weak, it means that they have the credit available and the capacity available for dramatic externally oriented initiatives. So in a way, you know, one road, one belt, or one belt, one road can be thought of as a kind of a domestic stimulus program. Sure. That provides new markets for Chinese companies. That's not the whole reality, but it's very consistent with the needs of the domestic economy.
So I think one of the obvious things, so a couple of obvious points to make. Firstly, it's slower growth from a significantly larger base. Mm. So 7% growth today from China is a bigger incremental contribution to global demand than 14% growth in 2007. Second point to make is that within the within that growth, there's clearly a progressive rebalancing taking place from investment and heavy industry towards consumption and services, and that affects the winners and losers in the rest of the world from China's growth. In the past, the winners were Chilean copper mines and Australian iron ore mines. In the future, it's far more likely to be US soybean farmers or manufacturers of luxury brands, and we're already seeing that transition taking place. The third thing to say on things like the One Belt, One Road initiative, I certainly agree with Professor Norton that this has a kind of stimulative effect on China's domestic demand. I think the other question on a sort of slightly longer term horizon is, does this fundamentally change the competitiveness of China's economy relative to other to trade rivals? Hmm. If you build significantly better infrastructure connecting China to neighboring countries, connecting China overland to Europe, then has that affected the competitiveness dynamic such that China can start outpricing its trade rivals again? If it does, then I think that would be a reason for a little bit of optimism about China's export prospects.
I would just add on to that, too, that I think if you look at the strategy, say, in particular with the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank and their ability to draw in a great number of partners, all at a fairly strong entry fee, if you will, they're getting funds coming in from others, yet they're taking the credit for the initiative. So pretty smart diplomacy in that regard.
That was Chris Johnson with Barry Naughton and Tom Orlick. And now on to our one to watch. Can Asia save world football? International headlines are filled this week with the United States Department of Justice indicting numerous executives and corporate associates of FIFA, World Soccer's governing organization, for bribery and racketeering charges. In cooperation with Swiss authorities, many of the accused were arrested in Zurich this week ahead of the FIFA presidential election, which many had expected longtime president Sepp Blatter to win easily. At the time of recording, the election is slated to go ahead for Friday, May 29th. However, few have focused on Blatter's only challenger in this election, Prince Ali bin Al Hussein of Jordan, who, in a quirk of FIFA's geography, is standing as a candidate from the Asian Confederation. The irony is that despite Blatter, the four-time incumbent, being embroiled in corruption allegations for years, most of the countries in the Asian Football Confederation will still vote for him and not Ali. While Asia's Soccer Federation has made huge strides in recent years and hosted the 2002 World Cup in Japan and South Korea, the federation itself is receiving renewed scrutiny. Its member Qatar is under investigation for bribing FIFA officials during the bidding process for the 2022 World Cup. A former head of the Asian Federation, Mohammed bin Hammam of Qatar, was banned for life by FIFA for bribing officials in the run-up to the vote of the 2018 and 2022 World Cups. Japanese tech company Sony actually dropped its sponsorship of the FIFA World Cup after the previous round of corruption allegations. In the bizarre world of FIFA politics, it may take a relative outsider such as Prince Ali to restore confidence in the organization. World football would certainly benefit if Ali can overcome the odds to become the first Asian Confederation representative to lead the troubled governing body. And that's our show for this week. You can always find more at cogitasia.com and csis.org. Also, check out our island tracker and maritime specific analysis on the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, or AMTI, microsite. I'm Colin Quinn. Thanks for listening.